Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
I'd also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
ATS Mix. The following is an ATS Mix exclusive.
Well, Dave, today's another red letter day for AboveTopSecret.com, the world's largest conspiracy website in the world, as we bring on a very special guest. Are you all primed and ready for this?
I'm very excited for this because, I really loved Ron Paul, and having this gentleman on who was his economic advisor for the 2008 Republican primaries, I'm pumped, John. I really am.
And let's tell everybody once again who we have on our show, considered to be one of the few non-biased investment advisors who have correctly called the current bear market before it began. Peter D. Schiff is the president of Euro Pacific Capital Incorporated, and he is our guest on the ATS Mix. He was an economic advisor for Ron Paul's campaign in the 2008 Republican Party primaries, and his extremely bearish views on the U.S. dollar, the United States stock market, the bond market, and the U.S. economy have earned him the nickname Dr. Doom. Besides being sought after, quoted, and appearing regularly on CNBC, CNN, Fox News, Bloomberg TV, as well as most major financial publications, he hosts his own internet and shortwave radio show called Wall Street Unspun. He's written such bestsellers such as Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, and The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets, How to Keep Your Portfolio Up When the Market is Down. It is with great pleasure to have on the ATS Mix, Mr. Peter Schiff. Hi, Peter. How are you, sir?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. We're so happy to have you on here, and we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. I bet, as we said in the bio, you are well sought after.
Yeah, I guess I'm getting a little bit more popular now. I mean, especially with that YouTube video that's been floating around. Somebody put together a compilation of some of my appearances on Fox and CNBC. And I think in the last few weeks, 850,000 people have viewed that. And so I think a lot of those people didn't know who I was before they saw that. And so, you know, I've been getting a lot more interest, you know, since that video started circulating.
You know, a lot of people, I know that you have, some 20-plus years of experience here in the financial markets. What were you like as a teenager that made you decide, hey, you know what, I think this is the career for me?
No, I mean, I didn't decide as a teenager. Since, you know, I got out of college, I went to UC Berkeley and just looking for something to do. And, you know, I ended up getting into, you know, it was a job on commission, and it was financial, and, you know, it seemed like there was more potential there than some of the other jobs I had, you know, that I could have worked in. I ended up, you know, getting into it.
We have a number of listeners and members that have submitted questions for us, which, by the way, in a 24-hour period, it was one of the fastest-growing threads on our website for members and listeners alike to post their questions for you. And one of the questions that we have here from one of our listeners is from Mr. Bill Irvin. His question is this: there's a lot of blame being tossed about from greedy lenders to home buyers overextending themselves. Do you think, if not for the highly exotic financial vehicles based on mortgage-backed securities and the insurance on MBSs spread throughout the globe, that this crisis might be limited in scope?
Well, you got to remember why so many people were acting so irrationally and were acting on their greed to an extent that we've never seen before. Because, you know, people have always been greedy. You just have to understand what changed and what led to all these bad decisions and reckless risk-taking, and you could point the blame to the Federal Reserve. It was the Federal Reserve that lowered interest rates so dramatically that made all this excessive risk-taking possible. I mean, the reason that people were able to buy houses that they couldn't afford was because of the teaser rate. The whole concept of the teaser rate came into existence because short-term rates were so low, and they were deliberately put there by the Federal Reserve. And Wall Street was able to speculate so much because the government made the cost of speculating very low, and therefore we got a lot more speculation because of the low borrowing costs. So, you know, if we had had a keen monetary policy where interest rates were far higher, then we never would have had a housing bubble. We never would have had all these credit default drops coming into existence. We wouldn't have had a subprime market. We wouldn't have had, you know, all the things that we're now suffering the collapse from.
Okay, member Skeptic Overlord says, given that we are above topsecret.com, people look for hidden motivations behind the scenes and the headlines. In other words, conspiracy theories. Is it possible, Peter, that this huge financial crisis has been helped along specifically so the government could come in and save the day, thereby creating maybe a method to channel federal money to favored sources?
Well, you know, I don't think these guys are that smart or that devious, but I do think that's the result. You know, I think that, unfortunately, you know, every time the government interferes with the free market, they create problems. And then, of course, as the problems become evident, it's the free market that gets the blame, and the solution is always more government, more power to government. And so governments always benefit from problems, even if they're the ones that created them. And that's certainly the case now. I mean, take a look at, you know, the housing debacle. Not only was it the Federal Reserve, but chief was among the culprits was the Fannie and Freddie, which were created by the government to guarantee mortgages and therefore encourage reckless lending. And, you know, we're suffering the results of that. And now, of course, the government is able to usurp even more power. I mean, look at the things that the government is doing now with the bailouts. You know, nobody questions the constitutionality of any of this. And, of course, none of it is constitutional. But, you know, we cede all kinds of power to the government when we perceive some kind of emergency that they're going to save us from.
Right.
You know, if you look at all the powers that they've gained over the years, the estate tax, the inheritance tax, the withholding tax, the majority of the taxes that we pay now were initially enacted during war times. I mean, even look at the Patriot Act that we have now. I mean, if there was no, you know, war on terror, they never would have been able to cram that the picture through Congress.
Speaking of the housing situation, our next member slash listener by the name of Springer has something kind of relating to that. He says, Peter, my question is this. I was in the trenches, SVP of a huge mortgage bank in Texas, and saw the dirty deals getting done with the worthless appraisals and the utter lack of underwriting criteria. So I had a unique vantage point that I assume many did not. How in the world did you discover all you did back in 2006? Did you have an insider giving you some truth?
Well, actually, I figured it out long before 2006. I mean, I saw this stuff coming basically even as early as 01 and 02. I mean, we should have had a much more severe recession. You know, during the dot-com bubble, I was very critical of the NASDAQ and the internet mania and the new economy, all that nonsense. And I was looking for a major collapse in the stock market, which we got. And I assumed that it would be followed by a severe recession. That prediction turned out to have been false. The reason that that prediction was false is because the government cut the recession short by dropping interest rates down to 1% and by, you know, cutting taxes and running up the budget deficit. So the government was able to postpone that recession. But when I saw what the government was doing, I was able to put, you know, connect the dots back then. And I saw what was happening in California to the real estate market. I saw how lending standards were being thrown out the window, and I saw firsthand all the crazy speculation, even in 2003, 2004, 2005. And, you know, so when I started writing my book, Crash Proof, you know, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, that book was written in 06, but the whole outline of the book and my trying to get a publisher, all that happened in 2005. So, it was a long time ago where I really saw this major crisis that was in the making because of what the government was doing. And I became very, very negative on our economy, you know, as the years progressed and as the bubble kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because I knew the bigger the bubble got, the more damage would be when it burst. And of course, I always thought, and if you read Crash Proof, you'll see that what I really feared was not the collapse. I knew that was inevitable. What I feared was what the government would do in order to try to combat the collapse, just the way they tried to combat the recession that we should have had in 2001 and 2002. And unfortunately, my worst fears have been confirmed by what has been done thus far and what Barack Obama is now threatening to do. And so the major damage to our economy is not going to come from the disease, but from the cure that the government is trying to impose.
Yeah. And speaking of Barack Obama, and I want to do a minor sidebar here, Peter, if I may, I would like to know what your personal reaction was when Barack Obama was elected president. I mean, at what stage did you say, oh, my God, or whatever you
well, had? I expected that he was going to be elected for a long time. In fact, I wrote that into my book, the little book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. You know, I wrote that he would win in a landslide. And that he would, that the Democrats would capture more seats in the House and Senate, but the publishers took it out because they were afraid that, you know, it would come out and the election would be in 2 or 3 weeks and I might look wrong.
Right.
I said, look, you know, I've been promoting, in fact, I was on television at one point and somebody asked me a question about John McCain, who should he appoint as a Treasury Secretary, and I said, why are you even asking me? I said, he's got as much chance of becoming president as I do. You know, I knew he wasn't going to make it, but, I mean, I wasn't surprised that he was elected. I mean, I've been predicting that a Democrat would win for a couple of years because I knew how bad the economy was going to be at the end of the Bush term, that nobody would possibly put another Republican except Ron Paul. I thought he was the only guy that had a chance, even though I admitted it was an outside chance. If the Republicans had nominated Ron Paul, he would have been the only guy that potentially could have beaten Obama because he would have been the only Republican that could run on a change platform and actually say, I was not part of the establishment. I was against all this policy. I predicted all these problems. And he would have had a chance. I mean, still, I still think Obama would have beat Ron Paul, but I think he would have had a shot. I thought McCain had no shot. In fact, I was surprised that it was as close as it was, even though it wasn't that close.
Sure. I'm going to pass this next question, my big unit, because it's already been addressed, and I'm going to go to member Spiteful God. What do you think of the concept of the Amero, and what do you think would be the most likely catalyst, Peter, for this to move forward?
Well, I mean, I think it would not be, it would obviously not be constitutional to have the Amero as our money, but I guess the Constitution obviously doesn't mean anything. I mean, you know, the Federal Reserve notes that we're using now aren't constitutional either, so, you know, I guess there's no difference. But, I don't think there's truth to the rumors of the Amero. I mean, maybe, I mean, there's a lot of people talking about it. There's a lot of people on the Internet about it. I even saw some video where some guy claimed to actually have one of these coins, but I don't think it's legitimate. But if there ever was a monetary union for North America, which included Mexico and Canada, obviously I don't think it would be a positive development, certainly not for the poor Canadians that might get suckered into it.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I think it would be America or Mexico with the peso. I think we'd be trying to find a way to breathe life into our dying currency, and maybe if we can sucker in more people, that it might postpone the you know, you're basically finding more chain for chain letter.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's funny that you mentioned this question here, Dave. I think I just read something or heard something where I guess South America is considering doing a regional currency. Have you heard about that, Peter?
No. I mean, I know there's all these, you know, the Middle East is talking about something. And, you know, the problem with our monetary system is not that, you know, we have too many paper currencies. It's that we have any of them. I mean, you can see our monetary system doesn't work. I mean, you have to have real money. You have to have, you know, gold. You just can't, you know, have politicians printing money and expect that you're going to have a successful economy. You're not. I mean, it just never works. I mean, politicians just print too much money because they can spend it and they can play Santa Claus. I mean, look at what we're doing now. Look at what Bush is doing and Obama. They're talking about all this stimulus. Barack Obama's now talking about a $700 billion or $1 trillion economic stimulus. But no one's talking about paying for it because they figure it's for free as long as they print money. And, you know, there is a huge cost exacted by printing money, and it destroys economies. And the politicians, you know, can't seem to figure this out until it's too late.
Right. Right. Coming from a conspiracy side, of course, some of the names that some of our listeners and members choose are quite funny. But this one is called Mo Freemason. And here again, this is pretty much a collaborative question that many people have asked here. So I'm going to apologize to a lot of our listeners that we don't ask their questions to, because a lot of these questions are already being answered by Peter. Mo Freemason says, you know, Peter, what should I do with the extra incoming in these upcoming months? Do I put it into a savings account? Do I keep cash on hand? Do I buy survival items? I ask this question because I continue to hear about the complete collapse of our economic system within perhaps 9 to 12 months. If so, I'm wondering what to do with my hard-earned cash.
Yeah, you know, I think that cash is not something that you want to hold on to. Even though cash seems to be reigning supreme right now, I think its reign is going to be very short-lived. and come to an abrupt end because the government is just creating much too much money. They're printing too much money. They're going to print a lot more money. So I would rather turn the cash into things that you need. Even if you don't need them today, you might need them in the future. So, yeah, stocking up on items that you think you might need, whether they're food items that won't perish or clothing or, you know, whether it's, consumer products, detergents, shaving cream, razor blades, things that you can hold on to, liquor, cigarettes. Yeah, I think it makes sense to stock up on that stuff now while you can still buy it. I mean, some of the stuff, if I'm right, I think we're going to have price controls at some point as inflation gets out of hand. Some of these products will be very difficult to come by. So you might as well buy them now while they're still on the shelves. If you have significant amounts of money, my advice is to invest abroad. I mean, buy gold and silver, invest in foreign stocks that have been, especially the ones that have been beaten up in the last 6 months, foreign government bonds. I mean, realize that America is in the most danger. We are the epicenter of this financial crisis. Ultimately, we're going to pay a much bigger price than the rest of the world. Right now, there's this, you know, the dollar has risen and U.S. stocks have held up well relative to foreign stocks, even though they've gone down. But I don't think that's going to last. I think that, you know, these moves right now are temporary and people should take advantage of it. That's what I suggested in my investment books. That's what we're doing now with my clients at Euro Pacific Capital. And if people, you know, really want to find out what I think they should do with their money, they should visit my website at europac.net. You know, read my stuff on my site, read my books, or, you know, talk to some of the brokers that work for my firm at 800-727-7922. That's 800-727-7922. And they can discuss what I think people should be doing with their money now before it's too late.
You touched on something that made me immediately go to this member question, since it talked about what's happening in the world and how the U.S. situation is affecting everybody. This is from member Zeus187. Peter, my question is global. I live in New Zealand, and I have reason to believe that our banking system is based upon the same imbalanced money mechanics as the United States. How exactly would the inevitable collapse of the U.S. dollar and its economy affect the smaller economies of the world, like New Zealand, and potentially the difficulties that we all may face later down the road upon the arrival, if there is a new major currency?
Yeah, well, you know, I have a lot of money personally and for clients invested in New Zealand and other smaller economies around the world. Ultimately, I think that the world is going to benefit from the collapse of the U.S. economy once you understand that the world has been subsidizing our economy for years, that Americans have simply been living off the fruits of everybody else's labor, and the rest of the world has had to live beyond below its means so that we could live beyond ours. And I think that, you know, as this crisis unfolds, to the extent that the world wakes up from this and decides not to lend us any money anymore, not to buy all the bonds that we're selling to finance all of our bailouts and stimulus, if they allow our currency to collapse, then I think the global economy will have a real boom. And I think countries like New Zealand will benefit from that. But to the extent that the rest of the world feels compelled to prop us up, and if they continue on this path, then the global economies will suffer as well as the U.S. economy. I mean, we're going to be borrowing trillions of dollars, maybe tens of trillions of dollars over the course of the next 5 years, and we're going to have to borrow it from the rest of the world because we don't have it ourselves. And, you know, of course, we're not really borrowing it because borrowing assumes you're going to pay it back.
Right.
We never pay back the money we borrow.
Right.
We just go deeper and deeper into debt. So we're basically going to ask the world to give us tens of trillions of dollars, and I think it's going to cost them a fortune to actually comply, and they would be very foolish to do it. And hopefully, for everybody's sake, including ours, they don't.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if they lend us the money, they simply encourage more of the behavior, and they allow us to dig ourselves into a deeper hole. I mean, it's like, you know, the world is like the pusher, and we're the drug addict. And, you know, by giving us more drugs, more cheap money to borrow so that we can consume, they simply make the problem bigger and enable us.
Yes. Right. Speaking of that economic drug problem, does China still hold pretty much most of our debt?
They don't hold most of it. I mean, they have over $2 trillion in foreign reserves. I think better than $1 trillion of it is U.S. dollars, which makes them by far the biggest creditor of the United States, or maybe not by far. Japan is probably a close second. But, you know, you have to add up all the other countries that were in hock to all around the world, you know, in Eastern Europe. I think Russia is the biggest one there, although the reserves have come down a bit recently. Certainly the Middle East countries, we owe a fortune over there. You know, Saudi Arabia is probably the biggest holder of our debt in the Arab world.
Sure.
But we owe everybody. We're an equal opportunity borrower. We owe money to the poorest people in the world, you know.
Right. Yeah, I wish they owed me. I mean, I'd like to have some of that interest, you know, but, yeah.
And here is somebody that is concerned about their own personal investments in their IRA. The BDK says, if we assume that there is a risk that the U.S. government is going to go bankrupt, Peter, and this does happen, where should I park my funds in my IRA or 401k? In other words, what will be a safe investment for me and my family?
Well, basically what I said, I mean, first of all, in the short run, there's nothing is safe. Everything is dropping. But if you understand the long-term negative implications for the U.S. dollar based on the economic policies and monetary policies we're pursuing, then what you'd want to do is within your IRA or your pension account, you'd want to get out of U.S. assets. So, you know, you'd want to look at foreign assets, foreign funds, foreign stocks, commodities, you know, commodity-type stocks, precious metals, things that will protect their wealth in the event the dollar becomes worthless or certainly worth a lot less than it is today. And again, you know, that's what we're working with people to do at Euro Pacific Capital. That's my whole strategy right now, is to try to protect the wealth of as many Americans as I can by recognizing that the dollar is doomed. And sure, that anybody who's caught with dollars when the music stops is basically going to be broke.
Interesting.
Right. I'm going to ask one of the multiple questions that Bunch did. This is I'm really curious to hear your answer on this, Peter. It says, how does it feel, Peter, to not only be proven right about all your analyses, but now that your colleagues, some of which, you know, went kind of out in left field to humiliate you off and on, how does it feel to be proven right? And where are all these people now that were giving you a bad time before, you know, how they feel about now that you are the kind of the guru of everything?
Well, they're still out there giving me a bad time, and most of these people still don't understand you know, that I was right. But of course, I'm not 100% vindicated. I mean, you know, many of the forecasts that I made with respect to the dollar, I mean, while the dollar had been weakening and commodity prices had been rising, which were forecasts I've been making for years, those trends have turned sharply in the short run. I did not predict that they would turn. And also, you know, foreign stocks markets have come down. While I assumed that they would come down, I didn't assume they would come down this much, mainly because of what's happened in the exchange rate. So, you know, I'm not 100% vindicated yet. I mean, I have a lot of clients who came to me only recently whose accounts are now down. They're not up. I mean, so, but ultimately, I think I will be 100% vindicated. I think that the world is, the reaction thus far to the U.S. economic crisis, which is the pile into the dollar, is temporarily distorting the investment markets. And I think ultimately, once the dollar finally rolls over and collapses and foreign economies recover, then I think I will be completely vindicated. I've been a big advocate of decoupling, and right now that is being discredited. So, you know, a lot of the things that I saw wrong with the U.S. economy, they've all come to pass. I mean, the credit collapse, the real estate collapse, you know, the bankruptcies and the financials and the fall of the stock. I mean, all that has been dead on accurate. But I haven't, you know, everything that I've said hasn't happened yet. I'm confident that it will. It's just amazing that, you know, people who have seen how accurate I've been over the years on many predictions don't necessarily give me any more credibility for my future forecast than the people, you know, who got it completely wrong. I mean, there are people who've never gotten anything right,
right,
you know, who for some reason people still think are experts and they know what they're talking about when they've been wrong on everything.
Yeah, really. I bet that's really frustrating for you too.
I mean, look at the people in government that are being, you know, given the authority to solve our problems. These
right.
are the people that helped create the problems. Or these are the people that didn't even see the problems coming. How can they solve a problem they don't understand?
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, yeah.
And speaking of such, the same listener, Bunch, asked another question, which was, hey, Peter, are there actually members of Congress or the executive branch that maybe seek you out for advice during this crisis?
No, nobody seeks me out. I mean, why would they don't want my advice? I mean, they don't want to hear my advice, because my advice, you know, is basically to the government is that, look, you guys created this problem. I can tell them how they created it. And I can tell them what they need to do not to create any more problems. But, you know, there's no magic bullet. I mean, my solutions involve less government, not more government. My solutions involve the free market. they involve a return to sound money. They involve higher interest rates. They involve Americans saving money instead of spending it, and Americans producing stuff instead of consuming. And it involves, you know, leveling with the American public, telling them the truth about their circumstances, and saying that there's nothing the government can do to make it better, that the markets have to make it better, that we have to roll up our sleeves and we have to go back to work. And if the government could do anything, it would be making itself smaller. It would be abolishing government programs, not creating new ones. We need to be slashing entitlement spending, slashing military spending. I mean, apart from the fact that these programs are wrong-headed and unconstitutional, we can't afford them. So we just have to put an end to it.
Right. Well, you know, it's amazing, as John just got through asking about what Bunch said. Here's another member that has a similar question. He's from the United Kingdom. The member's name is Being Matt. It says, greetings, Peter, from the United Kingdom. I've been baffled at how barefaced the other so-called experts on various interviews have ridiculed you on live TV. And I wonder, are you not ever motivated, Peter, to take extra steps to out these nuts as frauds? I'd be surprised if you didn't take these insults personally, especially after so-called neutral hosts in the mainstream media have joined in.
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, the people that are featured in that YouTube clip, maybe, you know, they're not the only people that were saying that. I mean, there's 2,000 clips of me on YouTube. I mean, not all of them are from network television, but a lot of them are. And a number, you know, I got the same reaction from just about everybody because, what I was saying was so outside the mainstream. That, you know, it's kind of unfair to say just a few of these guys were like that. I mean, pretty much everybody has been wrong. And look, you know, there are people that have received Nobel Prizes in economics that I think don't know anything about economics. There's a lot of ignorance out there in the mainstream with respect to basic principles of money and economics. So, you know, just because, you know, they dismissed what I was saying, you know, doesn't mean they're any more incompetent than anybody else. But I think in general, the people who represent themselves as being investment experts or economic experts and they're on television or on the radio or they get quoted in the print, most of them are completely clueless.
We have a option here at AboveTopSecret.com that allows people that don't actually want to post their name or identity on our website to post their questions anonymously, and this is one of those. Mr. Schiff, I listen to the EuroPac podcast and have learned quite a bit from these. While I know that we're a long way from the dust settling, I'd kind of like to get your perspective on entrepreneurial opportunities in this, if you'll pardon the expression, crap economy. I'm sure that there were some people who made money during the Great Depression, but I don't have any firsthand knowledge. Do you think that perhaps smaller sphere economies might be the way to go?
Well, I mean, certainly I address this topic in my book, the little book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets, as far as what people might do, you know, occupation-wise, business-wise, during this downturn. And, yeah, I mean, I do think that there will be a number of business opportunities that develop as a result of the restructuring and the changes that are going to take place in our economy. Those changes are going to take place more slowly because the government is interfering. And so, it'll make those opportunities less lucrative in the short run. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, there are going to be people that are going to profit and there are going to be people that are going to suffer substantially who can't change. And for some people who are more adventurous, they might decide that there are better opportunities in other countries and might pick up and leave. You know, just like 100 years ago, a lot of people came to America because opportunities were greater here, because we had less government than other countries and more freedom. Many people are going to find that after a few years, America is going to be a very unfree country, and there's going to be a lot more opportunities and a lot more freedom abroad than there is here.
Well, that's a perfect segue into this next member's question by the name of Carrot. Peter, it is my belief that in order for a one-world government to come about, there must be a global problem, which requires a global solution to ensure global unification. Do you feel that the current global economic issues, is it possible that we're heading towards a one-world currency or even a one-world government? And if so, are we on the verge of this becoming reality in our lifetime?
I don't know. I hope not. But, yeah, obviously, sure. I mean, this can get very bad if the governments of the world continue to follow the U.S. Down the primrose path to financial ruin. And at some point, there might be a movement to do just that, although I really don't think it's going to happen. I just can't see the whole world coming together and saying we're just going to have one currency I mean, and who's going to, in one central bank for the whole world? You know, you see the problems they're having in Europe with the euro, just trying to keep that together. You know, imagine trying to do it for the entire world.
Yeah, just a session in the United Nations alone would teach you a very fast lesson, I would think.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, maybe will it ever happen in the span of human history? You know, maybe, but I don't think this particular crisis is going to precipitate it. Although, certainly, it's more likely to happen during a time of crisis than a time of general prosperity.
Sure. A listener by the name of Goalposter says, we've all heard a myriad of bobble-headed pundits telling us how bad it really is, how good it is, how it will get better, how it will get worse. There's talk of depressions, economic implosions, generally everything going to hell in a handbasket. Yet we're still throwing trillions of dollars at it, and it isn't making much of a difference to us who are down at ground zero, trying to just live a relatively peaceful existence. In all of that, Peter, exactly how screwed are we? Seriously. I mean, how bad is it really going to get?
We're pretty screwed. I mean, you know, it's worse than most people think. But the problem is it's worse not because of the problem, but because of what the government is doing to solve it. And so the real danger is the government solutions, the government stimuluses and bailouts and all the things the government's going to do. If the government did nothing, it would still be very bad, but it would not be as apocalyptic as it's going to be because of what they're doing. The reason that another depression is on the table is because the government is in the process of creating it. The reason that hyperinflation is in the cards is because the government is leading us down that path. You know, we've had this phony economy for years, and I always knew that it would be very painful to correct it, right? I mean, just like if you're an individual family and you've been living beyond your means, you've been living on a credit card, you've been buying things that you couldn't afford, you've been, you know, driving a car you couldn't afford, you've been living in a bigger house than you can afford, you know, the resolution of your personal financial situation involves a ratcheting down of your lifestyle. Move, you know, get a less expensive car, you know, move into an apartment, you know, don't eat out as much, you know, until you can, you know, actually earn some money and rebuild your savings, you're going to have to accept a reduction in your standard of living. Now, it's not fatal. I mean, it just means that you've got to change, you know, and that's what we need to do as a nation. But unfortunately, we're not doing that. We're doing all the wrong things. And so it's going to be a much worse outcome. Instead of just simply, you know, moving into a smaller house, we might not have any place to live at all. And that, you know, we're just going to completely destroy everything. And what they're doing, you know, and these are the same mistakes they made in the 1930s. And, you know, that's why we had a Great Depression. But, you know, fortunately, the economy was solid enough back then that we were able to withstand all the damage that the government did and come out of the recession eventually anyway. But now, you know, the economy is far weaker than it was in the early 1930s and is far less sound. And so the government is in a position to do much more damage then, especially since now we have no monetary discipline whatsoever. We were on a gold standard back then. We're not now. And so this could be much worse.
Sure. All right. Rick 7111 says, Peter, I first want to thank you for being a patriot as well as an honest citizen. My question is kind of personal, and the reason I ask is because of the deep desire that compels you to stand against a formidable foe. How much resistance have you had against the media and the elite that would in no doubt like you to be silent? Our prayers are with you, and we know that you will always stand for the truth.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. I certainly don't have a problem getting on television. I mean, I do a lot of, you know, CNN and Fox and CNBC and Bloomberg, and I do get quoted and written up in magazine and newspaper stories. So I am out there. It's just that, you know, my views are very unique. There's not that many people that are articulating them. So, you know, it doesn't look like it's getting a lot of press. But, you know, relative to everybody else out there, I certainly get my share of the media attention. So they're not, you know, they're not blackballing me. It's just that, you know, they'll quote me in the news story, and they'll quote five or six other people that say the exact opposite, you know. And so they end up, usually it's the opposite point of view, right, that gets more credibility with the media. You know, so, you know, even though they quote me, they generally, you know, don't convey the point that I'm more likely to be right than the other people that they're quoting.
Right.
And so the other message tends to, you know, to get a larger platform than mine, even if individually I might get a lot more media time than other people.
Sure.
Yeah, and don't you think, minor sidebar, John, but don't you think a lot of that has to do, Peter, with everybody's belief, that kind of the GOAT standard, if you will? They see five people one way and one person the other way and say, well, we're going to go with five people, even though the five people may be dead wrong.
Yeah, and especially when the five people that are going the other way are from, you know, Goldman Sachs or, you know, work for the, you know, for the government, or they're the president of Harvard, or, you know, they're at major institutions that have a lot more credibility than Peter Schiff, who owns a small brokerage firm, Euro Pacific Capital. I mean, why do I know all this stuff? How can I be right when all these other people in more important, prestigious positions are wrong? And so the tendency, you know, is to believe the people, you know, in those positions, and to dismiss people from, you know, little firms. You know, people say, well, if you know so much, you know, and I remember having some debates with people about this stuff, and they would say, well, you know, but about inflation, and this Diane Swank was saying, well, you know, but the Federal Reserve, this is how they define inflation. And I said, look, I don't care how the Federal Reserve defines it. All I care about is what it is. And then she's telling me, well, but who are you? I mean, they're the experts on the ones. And I said, well, then who said they're the experts? If you go through in the Fed, doesn't mean they're experts on anything. It just means they had political connections and they got appointed. But people tend to think that the people in government, you know, actually know something. Instead of they don't know anything, they just know somebody and they got their jobs.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, boy, ain't that
I haven't
truth.
Met any government official yet that I think really has a clue of what's really going on, Peter. I don't know. Maybe you have more clout than I do.
No, as I said, what's happening right now is all the consequences of our phony economy. Everything is blowing up. You can't have an economy where people just consume, and you can't have an economy based on consumer credit, where we borrow money from abroad and expect our creditors to never want the money back. And it's just a giant vendor financing scheme that was destined to implode. And, you know, even guys like Alan Greenspan, you know, for years when he would be interviewed, he would always say, even in front of the Congress, that one day the chickens would come home to roost. He said, there's going to be consequences. We can't keep borrowing money forever. Eventually, there's going to be a major price to pay for the trade deficits and our low savings rate and all this. And he was right. It's happening. It's happening now. It's happening maybe sooner than he thought. But it's happening. And, you know, and these type of expressions, you know, the chickens coming home to roost, time to pay the piper, I mean, they're there for a reason. I mean, you know, we can learn from these things. Our forefathers, you know, understood. And this is what's happening. You know, we're paying the price for years of monetary and fiscal excess, for years of living beyond our means, of consuming and allowing our industrial economy to wither away and replacing it with a phony, unstable service sector economy. This whole thing is toppling. And this is the consequence. It's not the problem. What we need is to rebuild a viable economy. And the problem is the government is interfering with that. The government is not letting the free market function. Just like it interfered with it during the bubble, to create the bubble and to remove the normal market regulations that would have kept greed in check, that would have prevented a housing bubble or a stock market bubble, that, you know, would have kept our economy in balance. The government interfered and removed those counterbalancing forces, allowed these bubbles to inflate. And now we have the phony economy that's collapsed, and now they're preventing the market from cleaning up the mess. Wow.
This listener by the name of Vinny Vitadici says this, hey, Mr. Schiff, what do you think of Henry Paulson? And what can the average John and Jane Doe do to help wake up the public, for gosh sakes?
Well, look, I don't think much of Paulson at all. I mean, he ran Goldman Sachs, and he was at the helm when Goldman was engaging in all the activity that is producing the losses that the firm is now suffering. In fact, I think if he had not helped arrange the bailouts, Goldman Sachs would be bankrupt right now.
Sure.
So I don't think he did a good job at Goldman Sachs, and I think he's doing an even worse job as Treasury Secretary. He has repeatedly lied to the American public. He's lied to Congress. He is incompetent. He should resign.
And right. what can the average John and Jane Doe do to help wake up the public to what's going on?
Well, I mean, you know, they could get them to read my books. You know, they could get them on my website and listening to the things that I've been saying and writing over the years, as well as other people who have been out there trying to sound the alarm. You know, that the people who are leading us down the wrong path. And, you know, the people in positions of power, both on Wall Street and in Washington, you know, they're clueless. And maybe worse than clueless. Maybe, you know, I mean, either they're liars or they're ignorant, or, you know, a combination of both. But, you know, people need to understand what's going on. And not only that, not only is our economy in trouble, but our individual liberties, our private property rights are under attack. And the more power we succeed to government under the hope that the government is going to use that power benevolently to help us, that's not what's going to happen. You know, they're going to use the power against us. And not only are we going to lose our financial wealth, but we're going to lose our freedoms. And if we don't have our freedoms, we're never going to get our economy back.
Right.
All right, we're just going to have a centrally planned economy, you know, where the government is in charge of picking which industries get capital and which don't, who succeeds and who fails. You know, they're going to be dictating to companies and directing companies. And, you know, it didn't work in the Soviet Union. It didn't work in China. It's not going to work here.
Right.
All right. Now, this is an interesting question, Peter. I'm really curious about this one. This is from member IMD12C4 Fund. I have U.S. funds tied up in a trust, Peter, that may not be released until February of 2009. Is there any way to exchange these dollars for a more stable currency prior to the release of those funds?
I don't know. You'd have to check with the custodians. I mean, chances are February of 2009, I mean, that's coming up in just, a couple of months. So chances are he'll be okay until then. But if he doesn't want to take the risk, he should look into other investment vehicles that he can accomplish within that fund where he might be able to get into other currencies or other assets. But chances are, you know, by February, you know, the dollar will still have some value, you know. But you know.
We all hope.
This listener by the name of Moon Mine had several questions, but I'm just going to shoot right down to the bottom. And actually, I'm kind of curious to hear what your answer is on this. Moon Mine wants to know, what happened during your CNN interview with Becky Anderson where you were cut off in mid-sentence?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because there's been a lot of stuff on the internet, some conspiracy theories about how I was cut off. And, you know, there was no, you know, conspiracy to cut me off. I mean, whenever you do these shows, there's a satellite feed and they set up a window. And I think there was a miscommunication with CNN and the studio in Hartford, in Stanford, where I was doing it, as far as when the satellite window opened and shut. And the satellite feed just, you know, went down and cut me off. And so they had no choice, but you know, see, it happened at the satellite site where I was at Ascent Media in Stanford. It wasn't anything that happened over at CNN, but I think it was a miscommunication. The satellite feed just went down at a certain time and it ended up cutting me off in midstream. But, you know, there certainly was nothing intentional, and I've done CNN International. I was on again, yesterday, and we had an extra long segment, and then they went extra long just because the discussion was going very well. So had it been up to CNN, they would have had me on a lot longer, but unfortunately a technical issue prevented it.
Well, you can understand that us being the world's largest conspiracy site, we obviously are going to think in conspiratorial terms.
Yeah, but and usually there's a logical explanation. I mean, generally everything that happens is not as a result of a conspiracy.
Now, this is it. Now, I love this question. Existence Unknown, Peter says, one of the main arguments against Austrian economics is that it fails to use a scientific method to prove its theories and instead relies on logic. If there is a main argument against it, why is it that people like Ron Paul and yourself are so precise with your predictions that it stumps even the most avid users of mathematics and econometrics?
I'm not even sure I understand as far as trying to prove it. I mean, I think, you know, Austrian economics, you know, has shown to have been accurate over the years and in explaining how markets work. I mean, Austrian economics is very close to what Adam Smith, you know, originally devised when he came up with the whole science of economics. And it's the only theory, I think, that has withstood the test of time as far as what it's been able to forecast. I think the reason that Austrian economics is so unpopular is because it minimizes the role of government. And, you know, of course, Washington doesn't want any Austrians in Washington because their advice is, you know, stay out. You know, Washington wants economists that are going to justify a bigger role for government. And so that's perfect for Keynesians because that's all they're about is more government spending, more printing, more inflation. And I also think on Wall Street, I mean, they want those same types of economists as well because they want economists who have credibility in Washington. They want to hire people who were former, the President's Council of Economic Advisors. I mean, everybody wants that credibility. So all of the economists, that the big shot economists, end up being from those schools. And of course, all the leading universities are very leftist. I mean, they're all, you know, trying to justify big government. And of course, they want their a tenured professors to also go back and forth to Washington, D.C. And so, you know, the economists that end up getting to high positions in Ivy League schools, that end up going to Washington and top jobs on Wall Street, are all from this school of thought that justifies big government intervention into the economy. But there are plenty of people that understand Austrian economics, you know, that are in our university systems, that are working in companies. They just don't rise to the high level of prominence because when they have this view, they don't go anywhere.
Incredible.
And, you know, economists are never hired because of their accuracy. I mean, it's not like a regular profession. They're just talking pieces. You know, so it's not like it's like you're going to get a job as an economist because, you know, your economic forecasting is any good. You know, that's not why they're there. They're generally there just to show.
Right.
You know, and as long as you can recommend a big role for the government, that's the main criteria to your job.
And speaking of recommend, we'd like to recommend our listeners and members alike once again to keep in mind that available at Amazon.com and bookstores, your favorite bookstores all over, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, and also The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets, How to Keep Your Portfolio Up When the Market is Down, is available, and we suggest that you pick one of those copies up. Do you have perhaps another book that you're thinking of getting into or writing?
Yeah, I'm in the process. We're going to be revising Crash Proof with some updated information. I'm working on a revision cartoon book on economics that's basically, you know, a combination of two books that my father had written on the subject back in the 1970s. I'm just going to kind of bring them up to make them a little bit more modern. So that book will be coming out. And, you know, ultimately I'm probably going to have another book coming out. And the publisher, there's a lot of ideas that publishers want me to work on. I just don't have the time to write that many books. But I do want to write another book, a more extensive book, not necessarily on investments, but on economics, on how we got into this mess and what the real solutions are. But maybe I'll try to get that out around 2010, 2011, you know, when things are really, really bad.
Yeah, right. If we're all still around, you mean, right?
Yeah.
If we haven't been nuked.
Yeah, hopefully they can afford to publish it.
Publishing companies aren't
broke.
Do you have anything you'd like to promote, like any events or speaking engagements that you have maybe coming up?
I don't have anything coming up in the immediate future. People can go to my website, though, and have an idea of what my schedule is. I get a lot of requests for speaking now. Sometimes I get two or three a day. I do a lot of television. If people want to get my schedule, if they go to my website at www.europac.net, generally they can see what my upcoming speaking appearances are. They can see my upcoming media appearances. You know, I do my own weekly radio show every week, Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, called Wall Street Unspun. People can tune into that on my website. Also, it's on shortwave radio. So there's a lot of ways people can keep track of what I'm doing and read the stuff that I write and see a lot of my television appearances. And I archive a lot of the stuff, too. Now, I mean, most of it makes its way to YouTube as well, but it's also on my site.
We'll have shortcuts to your website and also to Amazon to show us where your books are. I think they can actually buy your books through your website, can they not, Peter?
Well, they can buy it through my website because I link to Amazon.
Okay.
So you can send them to my site and they can buy the books on my site. And if they do that, I get a little bit of money. I get, like, you know, I think Amazon gives me 50 cents.
Oh, then we definitely want to do that.
I get a little extra cash.
Well, listen, would you do me a favor? Like, you know, the 50 cents, any 50 cents that we happen to throw your way, would you kind of invest it in something safe for Johnny and I for a rainy day?
Before the 50 cents, you know, isn't even worth a nickel.
That's right. Hey, I got one last question before we let you go. If somebody in government were to offer you a position, would you take it?
Well, in what government and what would my position be? I mean, it's kind of a difficult question. I mean, there's a lot of government jobs that I wouldn't take.
Sure.
But, I mean, you know, if they offered to make me, you know, chair of the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, Secretary of the Treasury, would I take one of those jobs? Sure, I would take the job just long enough to eliminate it. I would try to do a lot before I resign. But my ultimate goal, if somebody made me, you know, would be to resign. But first I'd have to make sure that there wasn't any damage done once I left. there's not much chance of Obama offering me any kind of position, you know. So I'm not waiting for it.
Yeah, you're not holding your breath, are you, Peter?
No. people, a lot of times people email me, have I ever gotten a call? Has anybody, because you would think that, you know, hey, you know, you've been right about so much stuff. You think they want to at least talk to you.
Exactly.
To hear what you have to say. And the thing is that they don't want to know what I have to say. They don't really want solutions to these problems. You know, if they did, maybe they would be calling me. They're looking for political ways to paper them under, you know, to push them under the rug. And obviously, that, I'm not going to give them advice on how to do that. I don't even know if I know how to do that. I know what the solutions are, and I know that they don't want to know what they are.
And we'd like to encourage all our listeners and members alike that if you would like to get some sound advice, please go to Peter's website. And that's located, once again, where, Pete?
It's at www.europac.net.
Perfect.
Well, Peter, we can't thank you enough for your time. I know you were juggling us as you're trying to solve the financial crises of the world. We really appreciate you giving us this time on the ATS Mix. Until next time, Peter, we thank you again for such a gracious amount of time that you've given us and the members of the AboveTopSecret.com.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.